Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is feminism today. From Susan B. Anthony to Michelle Obama, Billie Jean King to Brittany Griner, Gloria Anzaldia to Pussy Riot, how have the meanings and signifiers of feminism shifted across cultural and political generations? Historically, feminism has come in waves and trends, has sparked wars of words and deeds, and has created a space for ongoing dialogue and questions, self-critique and internal conflict in the service of more nuanced understandings of the interconnectedness of all forms of systemic oppressions. In response to Beyoncé sampling her TEDx talk, We Should All Be Feminists, Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie said, quote, "I think that anything that gets young people talking about feminism is a very good thing," end quote. Joining me in studio tonight to discuss the culture and politics of feminism today are Danny McLean. Danny is a reporter and a fellow at the Nation Institute who covers gender, sexuality, and reproductive health. Her work has been published in outlets including The Nation, The New York Times' Room for Debate, Al Jazeera America, Color Lines, and Ebony.com. A former staffer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Danny has held strategic communications roles with colorofchange.org and Drug Policy Alliance. Welcome to the program, Danny.
Thanks so much.
And we are also joined by Andriana Clay, an associate professor in the Departments of Sociology and Sexuality Studies at San Francisco State University. Her book, The Hip-Hop Generation Fights Back, Youth Activism and Post-Civil Rights Politics, explores how youth of color organize and identify as activists in the post-civil rights era. Andriana's articles have appeared in several anthologies and academic journals, including Homegirls Make Some Noise, a hip-hop feminist anthology, the Journal of Popular Music Studies, and Meridians, a journal of race, feminism, and transnationalism. She also maintains a blog called Queer Black Feminist. Welcome, Andriana.
Thank you.
Later in the program, we will invite you, our listeners, to call in and join the conversation. Right now, you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. So, Andriana, I'd like to start with you. Can you define feminism for the purposes of this conversation and talk about how it's changed over the decades?
Sure. Well, I think there are many definitions to think about for feminism. The definition that I really like and kind of identify with the most is probably from bell hooks, who said that feminism is a movement to end sexist oppression or to end sexism. And I think that really allows for looking at feminism in a way that sort of goes beyond gender equality or some of the ways that we want to think about feminism is just about equality, but really looks at how different structures of oppression intersect with sexism. And so I appreciate that definition because I think it, in all of the sort of different iterations or waves of feminism, we could really think about that as an overarching one. But I think she really gets at it because it allows us to think about how all women from various backgrounds fit into that, and even men in some ways, fit into that definition. And that provides more of an organizing strategy, I think, if we look at it as a movement to end sexism.
And one of the things you talked about in that definition is intersectionality, which is kind of a big buzzword these days. Donnie, I was wondering if you could define that and how that fits in the discussion this evening.
Sure. So my understanding of intersectionality is that it's an analytical and strategic framework for understanding how gender, you know, gender is an important identity in our lives, but that it overlaps with other identities and experiences such as race and ethnicity and sexuality and ability or disability, immigration status. And so it's a way of thinking about how feminism intersects with other kind of isms and other ways that we think about organizing ourselves to fight for rights.
Both of you are very involved in online discussions in various social media and other media. How do you think young women today define feminism? Do they share that definition, or how do you think they think about it?
Well, I talk about it a lot with my students who are young adults or in their early 20s, and they really come at it from different ways. A lot of times they talk about they believe in gender equality, so that makes them a feminist, but oftentimes they have this larger critique around what that specifically looks like, rather than just looking at gender equality, but looking at like different industries like the media or culture or the workforce in different ways, but also reproduction and the family. So they have this like broader definition, but they sort of usually start with like gender equality.
And then your teaching helps them expand as time goes on.
Hopefully. Yeah.
What about you, Danny?
Yeah, I mean, I think young people have a range of experiences with, you know, how gender affects their lives. And I think, you know, it's been interesting to see how a lot of young people and not so young people, right, shy away from taking on the term feminism. And they may say, well, of course, I believe that I should be able to do anything a boy or a man does, but I'm not a feminist, right? And we've seen, this is years ago, but I remember when Lady Gaga, you know, dating myself here, but, you know, was adamant that I'm not a feminist. And she said, I love men, I adore men, by way of explaining why, you know, it would be impossible that she could be a feminist. And I think that we see that among a lot of young and not so young people, that feminism has a kind of charge to it and a kind of negative, it's developed a negative connotation as being not just someone who, you know, believes that you should have access to, you know, your full economic rights, your full social rights, but someone who is necessarily in some kind of antagonistic position with men.
And yes, and that gets to the big debate. Is Beyonce a feminist, right? This big debate that happened online. And let me read you, I read a little bit of the quote from Adichie about Beyonce actually sampling her TED Talk in a very popular song. And her full quote about it was, I think that anything that gets young people talking about feminism is a very good thing. I also think that I have a problem with the idea of feminism as being some sort of exclusive party that someone gets to decide whether you can come. And also the idea that somehow a woman who is comfortable with her sexuality, that there's something wrong with that. Now, I know you were both kind of part of this debate that was going on, and so I'd love to get your thoughts on Beyonce sampling this song and the fact that it there was so many strong feelings about it on all sides of this issue. Danny, what did you see?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I think it's important just to acknowledge that you know, Beyonce, in the very way that she released her album, made a huge and in many ways, you know, I would say feminist move, right? She released it on a Thursday night, a link on Twitter or Instagram. She did it in a very kind of, she made a power move as an entrepreneur. She didn't kind of go through the usual, you know, record company, you know, promotions and marketing process of how you release an album these days. So I just want to say, and showing herself as this very powerful woman entrepreneur, I would say that she made a very feminist move in that respect. The quote that you read, I think that Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie makes an interesting point about how feminism has become something that many people look at as this exclusive club, as something that's very tied to white women, to middle-class white women in particular, to people with college degrees, to people who can reference, you know, first wave and second wave and have this very kind of intellectual way of speaking about feminism. And I think that what Beyonce did that was so brilliant is she's challenged all that. The quote from the author that is in a song called Flawless. And I think, again, Beyonce's brilliant because when she initially released that as a single, it contains this lyric, and I don't even know if I can say it on the air, but it contains a lyric that was that many people said, how would Beyonce be calling other women bees, right? Like, she's Beyonce. She doesn't need to stoop to that level and kind of be in this, you know, antagonistic place with these other women and saying, bow down. And so I think Beyonce made this brilliant move by re-releasing the song as part of her album, but then having this incredible feminist analysis come in the middle of it. And I think by doing that, she is saying, I'm a feminist. You know, and I don't have to, it doesn't have to come packaged in the way that is palatable on your college campuses. It doesn't have to come packaged in a way that's palatable, you know, at these conferences that you all go to. It's a completely different way of expressing my power as a woman. And I think that's why she has been, the album and her in general, she in general have been so applauded.
Andriana?
Yeah, I think what I liked so much about these discussions around, well, first her album, her releasing her album in the way that she did, is the way that it got women talking, particularly women of color, like mm-hmm. writing about it and talking about the album in particular and what it meant and having all kinds of analyses of it. And I thought that was like the most important piece of whether or not Beyoncé is a feminist. Because I think she does say, in this way, I am a feminist. And she's talked about gender inequity in the workplace and in terms of like what women make in relationship to men. So in those ways, I think she may be a feminist, and she certainly embraces the term, or at least the ideology of feminism, or one kind of feminism. But I think what's more important is that she does that with the reach that she has. I mean, she has a platform to be able to say these kinds of things, and people are watching her, and people look up to her, and people listen to her, and people think about her in relationship to themselves. And I think that for that, in that way, I think she's a feminist, and that she's provided that in ways that other people haven't. Like, I don't think she shied away at all in the way that Lady Gaga mm-hmm. or other sort of musicians in the past have, like, explicitly said, I am not this. Mm-hmm. And she hasn't done that. So I think that's really significant in this moment.
I think another thing that I love about the album and about this moment is that she's brought sex back into feminism, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's made feminism sexy in a way that I think a lot of us have been yearning for, right?
Mm-hmm.
She has, I think it's become tiring, for me at least, to only hear sex talked about on the radio and in pop culture by men.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of that, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And especially because they tend to talk about it in this way in which the woman is the object. The woman is the recipient of the male gaze. The woman is kind of just an object for male pleasure and a playground on which a man expresses his kind of desires. And Beyoncé has turned that completely on its head and mm-hmm. said, no, I'm an actor. I have power in this moment. And I'm going to talk to you about what is sexually fulfilling, what is interesting, what is... what the things that I find kind of fascinating about sex, and there's something very powerful in that, and I think that in and of itself is also very feminist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I mean, she's sort of the perfect person or vehicle to do that, because Nicki Minaj, I think, does that also in similar ways, but doesn't have the same platform or isn't as polarizing as Beyoncé. So, I think Beyoncé really utilizes that and as a strategy to sort of reach people, or it can be interpreted in that way. In a way, I mean, Nicki Minaj has made some of the same comments around sexuality, or the fact that, you know, if men are aggressive or assertive, they get called bosses, and if she is, she's called the other B word, mm-hmm. right? But we haven't embraced Nicki Minaj in the same way that we embrace Beyoncé. And I think for that, again, that's such an important strategy that she's utilized.
Have you found a generational divide when you talk about the polarization to Beyoncé? Is it generational? And if not, what is it?
You mean, can...
Or is it younger people are saying, yes, I've liked this music, I'm down with Beyoncé from the beginning, and so now I'm listening to what she has to say about this, and it's relating to me, whereas older folks mm-hmm. may be more uncomfortable with some of the things she's saying, or not familiar with her and her music, and be like, who is she to come in here and get involved in this conversation?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen it sort of break down around generational lines. I think that older feminists are talking about her and sometimes embracing her, and younger feminists are. And then those same sort of intergenerationally, people have been making a critique about her in relationship to capitalism and the culture industry, and how she sort of plays that up, and how much can she really challenge sexism when she... The medium that she uses is such a sexist, you know, patriarchal institution.
I would completely agree. I don't see it breaking down along generational lines. I see it, you know, it's funny. I was at a dinner party with a friend of mine she's in her 20s. She's about a decade younger than me. And her parents, who are Sudanese professors who are in their probably 60s, and there were maybe like a dozen people at the table, and we talked about Beyonce for like 20 minutes, and it was this great conversation that brought people together across across ages. And I think I would agree. I think it's not, it's like, where do people stand on issues of sex? How comfortable are people talking about overt sexuality? How comfortable are people with the kind of intricacies around, you know, Beyonce called her tour the Mrs. Carter tour. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a position where you find that fundamentally anti-feminist because she's referring to herself by her, you know, husband's name and her position in relation to Jay-Z, then that's going to place you on one side of the discussion. But I think that you could find a 19-year-old who would hold that position in the same way you would find a 55-year-old who might feel that way. So I think it's really about kind of where people land on these questions of marriage and relationships and sex, how comfortable they are with folding these issues into larger questions around feminism.
And, you know, you've both talked about just the explosion on social media of conversation around this and the excitement around that. You both are very active on social media. Andreana, you have your blog, Queer Black Feminist, and Danny, you used to be at Color of Change for a number of years, which is one of the leading kind of online organizing for young people of color sites. Can you tell us how that's changed the dialogue and what your experience has been as more and more people have come online to have these conversations? Let's start with you, Danny.
That's a great question. I think what specifically Twitter, and I'm kind of a late adopter to Twitter, so I appreciate your kind words that I'm active on social networks, but it's more of a recent thing for me. So I think what Twitter in particular has done has created an opportunity for people who traditionally have been shut out of publishing to express themselves, put forth a point of view, and gain a following and build an audience. So, you know, I'm at a point in my career where I can pitch The Nation, or I can pitch Color Lines, or I can pitch Al Jazeera America, and, you know, chances are I'll get to publish there. But there are, A, it's taken me a while to get to that point. B, there are plenty of young women who just don't have that opportunity. And for them, they don't have to wait until they get that opportunity, right? They can start to have a huge impact on public opinion by just putting their ideas out there. And so, and then not only just in terms of kind of framing issues and sharing opinions, but also in organizing. So you did mention, I did work at Color of Change for 4 years as a strategist, and that's one kind of online organizing. But there's also just drawing attention to issues using Twitter and kind of using a hashtag or using, you know, some other way of kind of getting other people on board and then putting a huge amount of pressure on, you know, on whatever your target is, whether it's a corporate target or, you know, a media target or whatever. And so I think I think social networks have really opened the floodgates for people who have traditionally been shut out of publishing to build an audience for themselves.
Can you talk about some of the successes you had at Color of Change in pressuring corporations or others to make changes?
Sure. One of the big successes while I was there was, it feels like 100 years ago, but in the summer of 2009, this was after the kind of debacle with Skip Gates, where Henry Louis Gates was stopped on his porch as he was trying to get access into his home. He had been locked out, and he was stopped by a police officer there in Cambridge who then arrested him on his porch because the officer, who was white, and Skip Gates is an African-American professor, the officer felt that he was doing something, you know, he was breaking into this house. President Obama made a comment in the wake of that saying that he felt that the officer had acted stupidly, if I remember correctly, that was the word. And it kind of kicked off this huge, you know, firestorm that was kind of built and fanned by Glenn Beck, who at that point had a show on Fox News. This was also a summer in which the Health Care Reform Act was kind of making its way through Congress. There were the town hall meetings happening that summer all across the country where people were kind of hashing out the ACA and do we want this? Is it socialism? This and that. And so it was this very critical moment where Glenn Beck, in the midst of all this, called Obama a racist with a deep-seated hatred for white people. So this was the summer of 2009, so pretty early in Obama's first administration. At Color of Change, we started organizing to get the... We felt that this was beyond the pale, right? We felt that this was the kind of stoking of racial hatred that was dangerous. This is our first black president. You don't call this person a racist with a deep-seated hatred of white people. That's quite inflammatory. We started reaching out to the corporate sponsors of Beck's show on Fox News, and kind of making the case that did they really want their brands, you know, whether it be Pantene or whether it be Geico or whatever, to show up alongside this kind of race baiting that Beck was putting out there. And we ended up being very successful. We had 300 advertisers drop Beck's show. Eventually, Fox News had to run their own in-house ads to keep the show afloat. And within, I want to say, a year to 18 months, Fox News had canceled Beck's show. So that's just one. I mean, there were many. And, mm-hmm. and Color of Change continues to do incredible work. I'm no longer there. But that was just one of the examples of the way that we were able to leverage this online community of, at that time, more than 800,000 people around the country who cared about civil rights and racial justice issues to target these corporate sponsors and actually make a huge difference.
Andreana, as a teacher and as a blogger, how are you using social media? How do you see your students using social media to push these issues forward?
Well, I think my blog and on Twitter, I think, have been really significant places. Like, thinking this is, there's kind of a divide between what I do in the classroom a little bit and what I do online. Like, those things haven't entirely met, although I was talking to someone today and sort of thinking about it, more. But I do know that that is a place that students are really tuned in and think about, but sometimes also reject, like Facebook, and sort of, you know, they don't necessarily see Facebook as the vehicle for getting information. They see it more as sort of self-absorbed, kind of, you know, people posting photos of themselves, and they sort of get off of that and try and find other ways to really get engaged. And some of that is on Twitter and different blogs that they read, which I think is really significant. But it's kind of a divide. I've been surprised by it, actually, in terms of what they're engaged in.
Let me ask. There's a new documentary on Anita Hill that is just coming out, and it's been 23 years now since she testified at Clarence Thomas's hearings. And, 23 years later, we still see issues of sexual harassment and sexual assault heavily in the news, in the military, at universities. Just recently here at UC Berkeley, 31 current and former students filed 2 federal complaints alleging mishandling of sex assault and sex harassment cases. Where are we now? I mean, as Anita Hill is kind of coming forward in the public for the first time in many years, really a private person who just went about her business, how much change have we seen on those issues, given the recent news, both in the military and in our colleges and universities, about these ongoing problems?
Yeah, you know, I saw the documentary on Friday night. I was really excited to see it, in part because, I was 13 in 91 when the hearings took place. And so I remember it being on in my house. I remember that it felt important because black people were on television and on prime time, which was not something I saw a lot, especially in the context of news. It felt important because here was this black woman who was standing up in front of this Senate committee. It felt like things were going, you know, like she was under attack. You know, I couldn't quite piece it all together, but I knew that something important was happening. Mm-hmm. And so for me, watching the documentary was important because it put the story back together for me. And I think what really hit home was that, it was so interesting to see, like, Joe Biden, who I think was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee at that point, and then Ted Kennedy is sitting right next to him. And there are all these people who, you know, I mean, Ted Kennedy has passed, but who continue to be major players in progressive politics. And you really see and so she's in front of this, you know, panel of all white men, and you see the way that they just, A, can't really comprehend. They just feel so uncomfortable. But at the same time, they're stoking that discomfort because they're asking her to say these incredibly mm-hmm. embarrassing things mm-hmm. and relive these experiences. And for me, it just really drove it was shocking to just see the way she got thrown under the bus by so many different people who you might assume would be her allies, or at least would be open to and be able to hear what she was trying to explain about the workplace harassment, the sexual harassment that she said that she experienced at, from Clarence Thomas. And so the other thing that, so I think, I don't know how far we've come from that, to be honest. I don't know if we're really at a place where we can expect men within the progressive movement, people within the progressive movement to fully be able to grapple with and to come to the defense of and to really give a fair audience to a woman who brings these kind of complaints forward. What also struck me was that, there was a book called Strange Justice that was written by Jill Abramson, who's now, I think, at the New York Times, and Jane Mayer, who's at the New Yorker. And they're commenting in the documentary, and they, when Clarence Thomas made the comment that this was a high-tech lynching, they point out that suddenly it became that he had a race and she had a mm-hmm. gender. Mm-hmm. And that just really drove it home to me. And it brings up, you asked about intersectionality earlier. That's right. Intersectionality, right?
Right?
Realizing that she's a black woman. So are you saying that she, as a black woman, is somehow leading this high-tech lynching? But the men on this Senate Judiciary Committee were so frozen by what Clarence Thomas was accusing them of, I suppose, that they couldn't even respond to ask the questions about, well, she also is a black woman, so how does that complicate this, right? Mm-hmm. So in that respect, I think also things haven't changed, because I think as women, we're so often seen as just having a gender and not, as being the kind of sum of all of the various identities that we carry.
Andrea, I want to get your thoughts on that, but first let's take a quick station break. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing feminism today with our guests, Danny McLean, an Oakland-based journalist and fellow with the Nation Institute, and Andreana Clay, assistant professor of sociology and sexuality studies at San Francisco State. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website. Andreana, I would love to get your response to Danny's comments.
Yeah, I agree. I think some of the questions that really remain from that time, and I was 20 when that was happening and really starting to identify as a feminist, so it was really on my radar. And some of the same questions that came up then around issues of solidarity, like who do you sort of align yourself with? Do you align yourself with feminists, which means white women, mm-hmm. or do you align yourself with, your race, quote unquote, which means black men? Mm-hmm. And so it was this real divide, and I felt that divide very significantly then, and I think it's one that we're still grappling with now. Anytime I see that, including myself, a black feminist or a woman of color says something on behalf of young black girls. I think Rosa Clemente, who recently made a statement about this, and Brittany Cooper, who writes for Salon, have both been talking a lot about My Brother's Keeper, which Obama, the initiative that Obama recently talked about. And where do we talk about black girls in that? And the minute you say something about black girls, it becomes this divisive issue, and that's where you get attacked if you speak specifically on behalf of black girls, as if black girls are not black, or or if that somehow takes away from the larger issues of racism or sexism, that these aren't connected. And I think the other way we haven't moved that much away from this is that it's still difficult for women to talk about sexual assault and for us to believe women around sexual assault without delving into her past or into her current life or having questions about her sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I think that is still a significant problem. One movement that I have seen is that there are more men who do identify as feminist and who actually write and talk about these things in a similar and have a pretty wide reach, whether it's through social media or other forums through their talks. So that's been a significant change that I've seen.
Great. Well, we just delved on a lot of topics that I want to delve deeper into as the hour continues. But on intersectionality, I'd like to talk some. Danny, you write about reproductive justice, and if you could kind of explain what that is and how that fits into this concept of intersectionality.
Sure. So I talked about intersectionality as being a strategic and analytical framework, and I think of reproductive justice organizing as operationalizing that framework. So it's understanding that often people have needs that are not just about their gender identities or not just about their kind of their need to access abortion and contraception. It's about larger questions of family and community. I think one good way that I've heard it explained is that it's not just about a woman's desire to not have a child and therefore to access contraception or abortion, but to have a family of her choosing at the time of her choosing and the way of her choosing and to be able to support that family with dignity. And so what has been helpful for me as a reporter is actually speaking with people who are doing reproductive justice organizing. One example of that in the past year, so in April of last year, there was a successful campaign in New Mexico, and New Mexico has, I believe, the highest rate of teen pregnancy in the country. And there was a campaign that was led by an organization in New Mexico called Young Women United. And it was also something that the ACLU of the state got involved in. And it was an effort to change the attendance policy in schools statewide and to acknowledge that pregnant and parenting teenagers need to have some flexibility in terms of their, excused absences in particular. Mm-hmm. And so it shifted the number of excused absences that are, that are given to a student if she is pregnant or if he is, will soon become the father of a child. So to me, that's an example of reproductive justice organizing, right? It's acknowledging that people have a range of reproductive needs and a range of reproductive realities, and that those fights, alongside fights for contraception and abortion, are worth supporting.
And that they're all mixed in together.
Exactly.
You can't separate them
exactly.
And is this a concept that you've talked about on your blog, or that you've seen in the conversations that you've had in the movement nationally?
I haven't talked about it so specifically on my blog. I've definitely talked about it in reference to our everyday lives as women, like especially when I think there was a time like when the Sandra Fluke was getting targeted and the whole transvaginal ultrasounds, like those kinds of stories and actions that were happening. I was writing about that a little bit at the time around what our everyday experiences as women are like and how complex that is when we talk about feminism,
right,
or sexism, and how that is so much structured by who we are as women, whether it's young women or trans women or women of color, like thinking about that complexity, but like really looking at the everyday sort of experiences or interactions that we have. Not in the way that we're talking about microaggressions right now, which I think takes away from a larger discussion of sexism, or we're talking about it in terms of race right now, but really using that as a base to think about the larger movement, like how we experience it every day.
In terms of intersectionality, another group really advocating strongly for rights are transgender women, which you just mentioned. And I had the privilege last week of attending a lecture by transgender actress and activist Laverne Cox called Ain't I a Woman. And she was just phenomenal. But also the bond she had with the audience was just palpable. It was just so powerful to be there and see, as she said, this is our moment, and people in the audience feeling like they haven't had a moment before, and now they're having a moment. So could you talk about transgender women becoming more part of the larger movement or more accepted in the larger movement?
In the larger feminist movement or
yes.
LGBT movement or
take your pick.
Just in general.
Well, again, it's intersectionality,
yeah,
so it's really
yeah.
all of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that Laverne Cox and Janet Mock in particular are having significant moments right now where, again, like Beyonce, they are really using the platform that they have to talk about the larger movements. I don't know that they've been necessarily accepted or embraced in the what we think of as the larger movements necessarily, or if these two women have, then there's a larger community of trans right. women that we sort of, you know, anytime someone sort of rises to the top or has a platform, there are large numbers of women that we're not talking about. But I think what's so significant and personable, it sounds like, about Laverne Cox is how she does sort of bring us all into her discussions, right? And the way that she did that with someone like Cece McDonald, who was in prison for violence that was enacted upon her,
right.
that she, you know, used self-defense, and then she went, and all of that as issues of racism and cisgenderism and sexism and classism, and the way that we treat transgender women. And she really is talking about that explicitly. There was a Katie Couric interview that she did with Carmen Carrera, who was previously on RuPaul's Drag Race, but has since transitioned. And there was just this beautiful moment that Katie Couric tried to have her talk about her surgery, or talk about, I think she said specifically genitals. I can't remember entirely. But Laverne Cox just sort of moved the discussion sort of brilliantly to these larger issues of transgender women being poor and outside the workforce and having the most violence enacted upon them of any sort of group of LGBT people or of women. And it was just this really smart moment. So in that way, I think she's doing a phenomenal job, and Janet Mock, of sort of using the platform that they have to really bring people into that discussion.
Yeah, she talked about how she'd been a struggling actress for so long, and now she's so successful, and she's using that platform for the stuff she's always fought for.
Yeah.
Without even, I mean, it's just so instilled in her DNA that, of course, that's what she's going to do with the celebrity status she has
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Danny, I want to get your take on this, because you wrote a very interesting piece for Color Lines on Masculine of Center women. So I'd love to get your take.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. You know, Janet Mock and Laverne Cox are having a moment, and they're getting a lot of exposure, which is incredible. My reporting has put me more in touch with trans men, specifically trans black men, and a community that refers to itself as masculine of center women, which means, again, you know, identifying in many ways or kind of expressing as masculine, but not necessarily using masculine gender pronouns and that kind of thing. So I wrote this story because I have been very interested, and I hope we can circle back to what Andreana mentioned about the My Brother's Keeper, because there's this whole...
It's actually next on my list. We are definitely going to get there.
Excellent. So I have been really interested in the ways in which boys and men of color, specifically black and Latino boys and men, occupy this place in our kind of public narratives about being under attack. And I think I acknowledge that. I take nothing away from that. But what often gets lost in that is the ways in which women are under similar attack. So after the George Zimmerman trial in July, after the verdict came down in July, I wrote a piece about hate violence, basically, about the ways in which black masculinity is a threat, and the ways in which that doesn't only affect black men and boys, it also affects black girls and women who are masculine of center, and black right. Trans men and boys. And so what I found really interesting was that it maps, right? I mean, it's if someone is expressing masculinity, then they're going to be seen as threatening in the same way. They might invite the same level of violence that a boy or man would that a bio boy or man would invite. One of the things I found in my reporting is that LGBTQ people are nearly twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience physical violence. So you see how race maps on that as well, right? It's not just about gender expression; it's about how the two
right.
play out together. And also, this is a report from the National Coalition of Anti-Violence, that also nearly three-fourths of anti-LGBTQ homicide victims were people of color, and just over half were Black, and that's in 2012. So again, it was you know, a story about how, in the wake of the Zimmerman verdict, which really put these issues on the national stage, that there were still some people getting left out of the conversation, and that was the Masculine of Center community. And I want to say that two organizations that are doing very interesting work around that are Brown Boy Project, which has a lot of folks here in Oakland, here in the Bay Area, and also Brooklyn Boyhood, which is based more, you know, on the East Coast in Brooklyn. But those were two incredible sources of information for me as I was pulling the story together.
Great. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing feminism today with our guests, Danny McLean and Andriana Clay. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. And we do have an email that has come in from Kay, and this is for you, Andriana. What are the avenues through which you are noticing the politicization of your students? Is it reproductive justice, immigration, violence prevention?
Yeah, I really do see it right now in terms of immigration, specifically in California. Also, some around the ethnic studies fight, not just in Arizona, but across the country. I see people really organizing around that and sort of taking that on in various ways, both personally, but also politically, as we think about, like, who feeds this country in terms of, like, who does the labor, right, to do that, and looking at it along gender lines. So the immigration rights movement is certainly, I'd say, the one that comes to mind, sort of comes to the forefront.
Let's move now to talking about boys and young men of color and the president's recent initiative. And, Danny, you wrote about this in The Nation. Obviously, no one is arguing that it isn't a good use of resources. This isn't an us against them type of thing. But, of course, a lot of people are saying, hey, what about girls and young women of color who are facing major, major challenges as well? And what about the funding for programs and support for them? So tell us about what you wrote in The Nation about this.
So I think it's important to start this conversation by saying, you know, this has come onto the national stage as a conversation topic in the wake of President Obama's press conference in Chicago and him kind of launching this My Brother's Keeper initiative. What I wanted to get at in my article is that there was a press moment, but that this has actually been going on for quite some time. In 2006, there was a front page article in the New York Times that talked about ways in which Black and Latino boys and men had fallen behind. In the wake of that front page New York Times article, there became this effort among foundations to figure out how to fund programs that would address the needs of boys and men in the areas of education, criminal justice, a range of issues. So I want to make that clear, because I've gotten so much pushback about this that, you know, it's like, well, the Obama tries to do one good thing for Black people and you have to talk about how it's terrible. This is not about what Obama has done. It's great that he gave a press conference. And yes, I know that he is doing an administrative review to look at, you know, federal policies and programs that may be having a negative impact on Black and Latino boys and men. And that's great. But this is a $200 million initiative over 5 years. And that money is coming from the philanthropic community with some support from the business community. So I just want to get that out there that this is an ongoing thing that foundations from OSF to Ford, Cal Endowment have been on board with for quite some time. What I think is interesting, and thank you for saying that no one would argue that boys and men don't need the support, because they do. My question and my concern is that, very simply, where do girls and women fit in? Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about street corners, schools, criminal justice systems that are inhospitable to boys and men of color, girls and women are right by their sides, right? Mm-hmm. Boys and men don't exist in a vacuum. So if we want to think about the ways that, you know, for example, the school-to-prison pipeline, this idea that when a child gets, a young person gets booted from a classroom, suspended, expelled, it increases the possibilities that they're going to end up, you know, arrested in front of a judge, possibly pipelined into a jail or a prison. That's not something that's just happening to boys. It's something that's happening to girls as well. Black girls make up just over a third of girls in juvenile detention. So there are ways in which the face of, you know, who is how oppression is happening and is boys. But I was just very concerned about the fact that girls weren't fitting into that conversation. You know, $100 million over the past decade have been the philanthropic community has set aside for boys and black and Latino boys and men. Over that same period of time, just $1 million going to programs for girls and women. And it's just, you know, there's this argument that, you know, boys and men need support in terms of employment programs. Well, you know, we've seen, so we're just pulling ourselves out of the recession slowly but surely. The unemployment rate declined slightly for black men between 2009 and 2011, but joblessness actually increased for black women over that same period of time. And to not acknowledge that means that we're looking away from the fact that we have a lot of female-headed households in our communities, right? So, there's a lot that I think needs to be addressed with this, and I'm so glad that, as you mentioned, Brittany Cooper, you know, Rosa Clemente, other people have gotten on board with this conversation, because I see the ways that it's bubbling up and that the philanthropic community hopefully will respond soon.
Yeah, and it makes it increasingly more difficult to really challenge that narrative when it's being supported in such important financial ways, right? And it's great that President Obama, you know, aligns himself and talks about himself as a black boy and what it would be like if he had a son in relationship to this initiative. But I do think that it severely overlooks young women, and just the young women that we sort of have in our minds. Like, just to piggyback off of what you were saying earlier, I did write on my blog last week about the murders of Brittany Cosby and Crystal Jackson, who were two black lesbians in Texas who, it appears, were murdered by Brittany Cosby's father, right? But just the outrage and sort of outcry about the violence directed towards women's bodies, or Renisha McBride, mm-hmm. or other people that have been murdered because of their race and gendered and sexualized bodies, right, is nowhere near the sort of outcry or longevity that we've had around the murdering of black and brown boys, right? And it's not a contest.
Exactly.
But if we're going to have that conversation about violence towards particular racialized bodies, it has to be an equal gendered discussion, whether it's cisgender or transgender or queer or straight or boy or girl. And it hasn't really gotten to that point, which is sort of the same sort of trajectory from Anita Hill. We have not expanded that conversation.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Rosie on the line from San Jose. Rosie, welcome to City Visions. Rosie from San Jose, are you with us? Okay, it looks like we're having some technical difficulties, so we will keep rolling and come back to Rosie when we get the chance. We were speaking about President Obama, and I'd like to get your sense of what it would mean if Hillary Clinton becomes our first female president, as is certainly a plausible thing that could happen in 2016. You talked about the way with the young men and boys of color, how President Obama can talk about his own personal experience. What would it mean for the issues you're talking about to have a woman president, a white woman president, a upper middle class woman president, but nonetheless a woman president?
To talk about similar issues.
Well, what would it mean at the policy level, do you mm-hmm. think, to have someone who has personally experienced some of the things we're talking about?
I don't know. I mean, it's just been interesting to watch her career in general, from being a lawyer to being first lady to being secretary of state, and how much she was targeted as a woman in those roles, and how little room she had to make mistakes or to, you know, speak sort of assertively, even though that's how we often think about her, but she was just attacked over and over again for her various decisions and the way that she interacted with the media and the way she interacted with Congress and the way that she interacted on the campaign trail. So it's hopeful that some of that discourse would shift around gender and sexuality and, you know, in relationship to sexism and women. But it feels like there's a huge wall to get through. I mean, she's just going to be so trampled, I feel like, in much the same way that Obama is trampled around race.
Exactly.
Like, I'm torn.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was going to say exactly that. I think in the same way that we have not seen Obama really take the lead on addressing the needs of communities of color, specifically Black communities, I don't think we could expect that the first woman president would really be some kind of champion for gender justice. I think that the stakes are a little too high politically and that there would be this real feeling that she would need to prove herself as a serious politician, which means, of course, that you can't speak explicitly about gender. So, I mean, who knows? We'll see. I remember, you know, Hillary Clinton being that person who was trying to push healthcare reform and getting completely stonewalled around that. Maybe, who knows, but I feel similarly to Andreana. I think that she would be up against a lot of challenges if she were trying to push a real agenda around gender.
Mm-hmm.
We just have a few minutes left. It's officially Women's History Month, and I'd like to ask each of you a few things about that. If you can meet one woman in history, who would it be and why? There can be multiple people you might want to meet with, but you can just talk about one of them.
Throw out, you know, I would really like to meet Harriet Tubman.
Oh my gosh, I was just so funny.
I would really, because, yeah, I mean, what an incredible. I would like to ask Harriet Tubman how she overcame fear. You know, I mean, as someone who was undertaking incredibly dangerous missions to get people to the North and to freedom or relative freedom at that point in time, I would love to talk to her about how she overcame her fear and what made her keep going back even after she was free.
Yeah, I immediately thought of her and also Ida B. Wells, just around sort of their activism. So outspoken in their writing and in their organizing to get, I mean, Harriet Tubman in her organizing, but just their steadfastness and they were unequivocally like on the missions that they were on, and nothing was going to get in their way, and that kind of fierceness, for lack of a better word, I find really challenging sometimes in my own life, and it's one that I really aspire to and feel inspired by.
Talking about fierceness, who are some of the feminist leaders today that you think are carrying the movement forward, who people might not know about but should keep their eye on moving forward?
Well, I do really like Rosa Clemente. I don't know if she necessarily identifies as feminist, but what she puts out there as an organizer, as an activist, as a writer, I think is so significant. How she identifies as a Black Puerto Rican, how she speaks out on behalf of young women and girls and talks really explicitly about class. Like, she takes on challenges in a way that I am often inspired by, for lack of a better word. But I think that's someone that people should have their eye on. And she's a hip-hop organizer, and she very much links herself to that movement.
Danny, I actually want to ask both. Well, let me let you answer that question first, and then.
I am really privileged to get to meet a lot of organizers over the course of my reporting. I think I mentioned the work of Brown Boy Project. I don't know if Erica Woodland and B. Cole identify as feminists necessarily, but their work around gender is incredible. You know, gosh, there are so many. I really admire the writing that some people, and you just spoke about this, Andreana, Akiba Solomon at Color Lines. She's a colleague. She's incredible. Jamila Lemieux at Ebony.com. I mean, there's just, I feel like there's this group of Black women who are just doing incredible writing right now. But there are so many, and I want to stop there because I'll just forget so many people who I admire.
No problem. Andreana, you mentioned hip-hop, and you've written a lot about hip-hop. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of time left, but I'd like to delve into this a little bit with you, which is, you know, how hip-hop is perceived. Many people perceive it as misogynist or sexist or homophobic. Mm-hmm. And kind of what I know you've worked with young people in Oakland, and that has influenced your work a lot, mm-hmm. Kind of the hip-hop generation. If you could just speak to your experiences there and what you're actually seeing, and does it match the perception that is out there sometimes in mainstream culture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is misogynist and sexist and homophobic, but so is our larger American culture. And we want to point to hip-hop as being sort of this problem or the root of that, as if it emerged on its own, like those things emerged on their own, or the rappers specifically that get targeted, or the people who participate in hip-hop and bop our heads along or consume it in particular ways are responsible for the misogyny in hip-hop in society. So it's an easy target, but it's such a significant space for different generations of people in terms of representation and seeing ourselves and having a voice. We were talking about social media or new media earlier, and I think for many of us, hip-hop was that place where you were able to talk, and you were able to talk back, and you were able to see images of yourself, whatever they may be, and also critique them. Like, I think there's an assumption that young people in particular, or any of us that consume hip-hop, aren't critical of it. But I hear young women all the time, you know, being critical of what they see in hip-hop, and that's significant, and I think hip-hop provides that room. It's not as sort of rigid as we think, and it's certainly not the culprit.
Great. Thank you. There's a lot more we could say on that, but we are running out of time. We just have a few minutes left, and just wanted to give each of you a moment to talk about some of the things you're working on going forward. Danny, are there certain areas or articles that you see working on in the coming year, and kind of with your research, Andreana, what you'll be working on going forward?
Mm-hmm. I'm always looking for a good story. I just wrote a story about this really interesting use of text messaging to help recently arrived immigrant women, Spanish-speaking women in the Central Valley, specifically in Fresno County, to connect them with health resources and resources around domestic violence. So that's a recent story that I just wrote. Very interested in, there's a bunch of talk about the sex trade. I'm working on a piece right now about that, and very interested in the people who are doing organizing with sex workers. So yeah, always looking for a good story, and always open to people sharing their ideas for what needs to get covered.
Andrea?
Well, I just, in terms of academically, I've been writing about representations of queer sexuality in different mediums, on television, reality television, and online, and really thinking about that in this moment where we are becoming increasingly what people call homonormative, like where the queer culture is becoming more normalized. So looking at that, I'm also really early into writing about crack cocaine and loss in the Black community and the emotional work around that moment, a specific moment in the 80s and 90s, but also the longevity of that.
Terrific. And we will have links to both of your work on our website, so listeners can go to kalw.org to get more information. We also want to apologize for our technical difficulties this morning, that we weren't able to open up the phone lines with these terrific guests. We apologize for that, and certainly we'll have that fixed by next week. We are out of time. That is City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Danny McLean, Oakland-based journalist and fellow with the Nation Institute, and Andreana Clay, assistant professor of sociology and sexuality studies at San Francisco State University. Thanks very much for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Next week, join my co-host Joseph Pache on Monday night as we'll discuss San Francisco's wealth gap. Thanks for listening, good night, and have a great week.